Chapter 2. Ada's letters breathed, writhed, lived. Van's Letters from Terra, a philosophical novel, showed no sign of life whatsoever. "I disagree. It's a nice, nice little book," Ada's note. He had written it involuntarily, so to speak, not caring a dry fig for literary fame. Neither did pseudonymity tickle him in reverse, as it did when he danced on his hands. Though Van Veen's vanity often cropped up in the drawing room prattle among fan-wafting ladies, this time his long blue pride feathers remained folded. What, then, moved him to contrive a romance around a subject that had been worried to extinction in all kinds of star rats and space aces? We, whoever we are, might define the compulsion as a pleasurable urge to express through verbal imagery a compendium of certain inexplicably correlated vagaries observed by him in mental patients, on and off, since his first year at Chose. Van had a passion for the insane, as some have for arachnids or orchids. There were good reasons to disregard the technological details involved in delineating intercommunication between Terra the Fair and our terrible anti-Terra. His knowledge of physics, mechanicalism, and that sort of stuff had remained limited to the scratch of a prep school blackboard. He consoled himself with the thought that no censor in America or Great Britain would pass the slightest reference to magnetic gewgaws. Quietly, he borrowed what his greatest forerunners, Counterstone, for example, had imagined in the way of a manned capsule's propulsion, including the clever idea of an initial speed of a few thousand miles per hour, increasing, under the influence of a Counterstonian type of intermediate environment between sibling galaxies, to several trillions of light years per second, before dwindling harmlessly to a parachute's indolent descent, elaborating in new, irrational fabrications, all that Saraniana and physics fiction would have been not only a bore but an absurdity. For nobody knew how far Terra, or other innumerable planets with cottages and cows, might be situated in outer or inner space. Inner, because why not assume their microcosmic presence in the golden globules ascending, quick, quick, in this flute of Moet, or in the corpuscles of my Van Veen's, or my Ada Veen's, bloodstream, or in the pus of a Mr. Necto's ripe boil newly lanced in nectar or nekton. Moreover, although reference works existed on library shelves in available and redundant profusion, no direct access could be obtained to the banned or burned books of the three cosmologists, Zertigny, Yeats, and Zotov, pen names, who had recklessly started the whole business half a century earlier, causing and endorsing panic, demency, and execrable romantics. All three scientists had vanished now. X had committed suicide, Y had been kidnapped by a laundryman and transported to Tartary, and Z, a ruddy, white-whiskered old sport, was driving his Yakima jailers crazy by means of incomprehensible crepitations, ceaseless invention of invisible inks, chameleonizations, nerve signals, spirals of outgoing light and feats of ventriloquism that imitated pistol shots and sirens. Poor Van. In his struggle to keep the writer of the letters from Terra strictly separate from the image of Ada, he guilt and carmined Teresa until she became a paragon of banality. This Teresa maddened with her messages a scientist on our easily maddened planet, his anagram-looking name, Sig Lemansky, had been partly derived by Van from that of Aqua's last doctor. When Lemansky's obsession turned into love, and one sympathy got focused on his enchanting, melancholy, betrayed wife, nay, Antilia Glemms, our author found himself confronted with the distressful task of now stamping out in Antilia, a born brunette, all traces of Ada, thus reducing yet another character to a dummy with bleached hair. After beaming to Sig a dozen communications from her planet, Teresa flies over to him, and he, in his laboratory, has to place her on a slide under a powerful microscope in order to make out the tiny, though otherwise perfect, shape of his Minikin sweetheart, a graceful microorganism extending transparent appendages toward his huge, humid eye. Alas, the testibulus, test tube, never to be confused with testiculus, orchid, with Teresa swimming inside like a micro mermaid, is accidentally thrown away by Professor Lehmann's, he had trimmed his name by that time, assistant Flora, initially an ivory-pale, dark-haired funist beauty, whom the author transformed just in time into a third bromidic dummy with a dun bun. Antilia later regained her husband, and Flora was weeded out. Ada's addendum. On Terra, Teresa had been a roving reporter for an American magazine, thus giving Vaughn the opportunity to describe the sibling planet's political aspect. This aspect gave him the least trouble, presenting as it did a mosaic of painstakingly collated notes from his own reports on the transcendental delirium of his patients. Its acoustics were poor. Proper names often came out garbled. A chaotic calendar messed up the order of events, but on the whole, the colored dots did form a geomantic picture of sorts. As earlier experimenters had conjectured, our annals lagged by about half a century behind Terra's along the bridges of time, but overtook some of its underwater currents. At the moment of our sorry story, the King of Terra's England, yet another George, there had been apparently at least half a dozen bearing that name before him, ruled or had just ceased to rule over an empire that was somewhat patchier, with alien blanks and blots between the British Islands and South Africa, than the solidly conglomerated one on our anti-Terra. Western Europe presented a particularly glaring gap. Ever since the 18th century, when a virtually bloodless revolution had dethroned the Capetians and repelled all invaders, Terra's France flourished under a couple of emperors and a series of bourgeois presidents, of whom the present one, Dumerci, seemed considerably more lovable than Milord Gaul, governor of Lute. Eastward, instead of Khan Soso and his ruthless Sovietnamur Khanate, a super-Russia dominating the Volga region and similar watersheds, was governed by a sovereign society of solicitous republics, or so it came through, which had superseded the Tsars, conquerors of Tartary and Terst. Last but not least, Atov the Future, a fair-haired giant in a natty uniform, the secret flame of many a British nobleman, honorary captain of the French police and benevolent ally of Rus and Rome, was said to be in the act of transforming a gingerbread Germany into a great country of speedways, immaculate soldiers, brass bands, and modernized barracks for misfits and their young. No doubt much of that information, gleaned by our therapists, as Vaughn's colleagues were dubbed, came in a botched form. But the strain of sweet happiness could be always distinguished as an all-pervading note. Now the purpose of the novel was to suggest that Terra cheated, that all was not paradise there, that perhaps in some ways human minds and human flesh underwent on that sibling planet worse torments than on our much-maligned Demonia. In her first letters, before leaving Terra, Teresa had nothing but praise for its rulers, especially Russian and German rulers. In her later messages from space, she confessed that she had exaggerated the bliss, had been, in fact, the instrument of cosmic propaganda. A brave thing to admit, as agents on Terra might have yanked her back or destroyed her in flight had they managed to intercept her undissembling Angelus, now mostly going one way, our way. Don't ask Vaughn by what method or principle. Unfortunately, not only mechanicalism, but also moralism could hardly be said to constitute something in which he excelled, and what we have rendered here in a few leisurely phrases took him 200 pages to develop and adorn. We must remember that he was only 20, that his young, proud soul was in a state of grievous disarray, that he had read too much and invented too little, and that the brilliant mirages which had risen before him when he felt the first pangs of book birth on Cordulus Terrace were now fading under the action of prudence, as did those wonders which medieval explorers back from Cathay were afraid to reveal to the Venetian priest or the Flemish Philistine. He devoted a couple of months, it chose, to copying in a clean hand his scarecrow scribblings, and then heavily re-correcting the result, so that his final copy looked like a first draft when he took it to an obscure agency in Bedford to have it secretly typed in triplicate. This he disfigured again during his voyage back to America on board the Queen Guinevere. And in Manhattan, the galleys had to be reset twice, owing not only to the number of new alterations, but also to the eccentricity of Van's proofreading marks. Letters from Terra by Voltemand came out in 1891 on Van's 21st birthday, under the imprint of two bogus houses, Abencerraj in Manhattan and Zegris in London. Had I happened to see a copy, I would have recognized Chateaubriand's Lepotchka, and hence your little paw, at once. His new lawyer, Mr. Gromwell, whose really beautiful floral name suited somehow his innocent eyes and fair beard, was a nephew of the great Gromchevsky, who, for the last 30 years or so, had managed some of de Man's affairs with good care and acumen. Gromwell nursed Van's personal fortune no less tenderly, but he had little experience in the intricacies of book publishing matters, and Van was an absolute ignoramus there, not knowing, for example, that review copies were supposed to go to the editors of various periodicals, or that advertisements should be purchased and not be expected to appear by spontaneous generation in full-page adulthood between similar blurbs boosting The Possessed by Miss Love and The Puffer by Mr. Dukes. For a fat little fee, Gwen, one of Mr. Gromwell's employees, was delegated not only to entertain Van, but also to supply Manhattan bookstores with one half of the printed copies, whilst an old lover of hers in England was engaged to place the rest in the bookshops of London. The notion that anybody kind enough to sell his book should not keep the $10 or so that every copy had cost to manufacture seemed unfair and illogical to Van. Therefore, he felt sorry for all the trouble that underpaid, tired, bare-armed, brunette-pale shopgirls had no doubt taken in trying to tempt dour homosexuals with his stuff. Here's a rather fancy novel about a girl called Terra. When he learned from a careful study of a statement of sales, which his stooges sent him in February 1892, that in 12 months only 6 copies had been sold, 2 in England and 4 in America. Statistically speaking, no reviews could have been expected, given the unorthodox circumstances in which poor Terra's correspondence had been handled. Curiously enough, as many as 2 did appear. One by the first clown in Elsinore, a distinguished London weekly, popped up in a survey entitled, with a British journalist's fondness for this kind of phony wordplay, Terre à Terre, 1891, and dealt with the year's space romances, which by that time had begun to fine off. He sniffed Voltemand's contribution as the choicest of the lot, calling it, alas with unerring flair, a sumptuously fripped up, trite, tedious, and obscure fable, with a few absolutely marvelous metaphors marring the otherwise total ineptitude of the tale. The only other compliment was paid to poor Voltemand in a little Manhattan magazine, The Village Eyebrow, by the poet Max Misspell, another botanical name, Medlar in English, member of the German department at Goluba University. Herr Misspell, who liked to air his authors, discerned in Letters from Terra the influence of Osberg, Spanish writer of pretentious fairy tales and mystico-allegoric anecdotes, highly esteemed by short-shift Thessalists, as well as that of an obscene ancient Arab, expounder of anagrammatic dreams, Ben Sirin, thus translated by Captain de Roux, according to Burton in his adaptation of Nefsawi's treatise on the best method of mating with obese or hunchbacked females, The Perfumed Garden, Panther Edition, page 187, copy given to 93-year-old Baron von Wien by his ribald physician, Professor Lagos. His critique ended as follows. If Mr. Voltimand, or Voltimand, or Mandelatov is a psychiatrist, as I think he might be, then I pity his patience while admiring his talent. Upon being cornered, Gwen, a fat little fille de joie, by inclination, if not by profession, squealed on one of her new admirers, confessing she had begged him to write that article because she could not bear to see Von's crooked little smile at finding his beautifully bound and boxed book so badly neglected. She also swore that Max not only did not know who Voltimand really was, but had not read Von's novel. Von toyed with the idea of challenging Mr. Metlar, who he hoped would choose swords, to a duel at dawn in a secluded corner of the park, whose central green he could see from the penthouse terrace where he fenced with a French coach twice a week, the only exercise, save riding, that he still indulged in. But to his surprise and relief, for he was a little ashamed to defend his novelette and only wished to forget it, just as another unrelated Veen might have denounced, if allowed a longer life, his prepubescent dream of ideal bordels, Max Mushmela, Russian for Medlar, answered Van's tentative cartel with the warm-hearted promise of sending him his next article, The Weed Exiles the Flower, Melville and Marvel. A sense of otiose emptiness was all Van derived from those contacts with literature. Even while writing his book, he had become painfully aware how little he knew his own planet, while attempting to piece together another one from jagged bits filched from deranged brains. He decided that after completing his medical studies at Kingston, which he found more congenial than good old Cho's, he would undertake long travels in South America, Africa, India. As a boy of 15, Eric Veen's age of fluorescence, he had studied with the poet's passion the timetables of three great American transcontinental trains that one day he would take. Not alone. Now alone. From Manhattan via Mephisto, El Paso, Meskakansk, and the Panama Channel, the dark red New World Express reached Brasilia and Wich, or Vidma, founded by a Russian admiral. There it split into two parts, the eastern one continuing to Grant's Horn, and the western returning north through Valparaiso and Bogota. On alternate days, the fabulous journey began in Yukonsk, a two-way section going to the Atlantic seaboard, while another, via California and Central America, roared into Uruguay. The dark blue African Express began in London and reached the Cape by three different routes, through Nigero, Rhodesia, or Ethiopia. Finally, the Brown Orient Express joined London to Ceylon and Sydney via Turkey and several channels. It is not clear when you are falling asleep, while all continents except you begin with an A. Those three admirable trains included at least two carriages in which a fastidious traveler could rent a bedroom with bath and water closet and a drawing room with a piano or a harp. The length of the journey varied according to Von's predominant mood. When at Eric's age, he imagined the landscapes unfolding all along his comfortable, too comfortable, fauteuil. Through rainforests and mountain canyons and other fascinating places. Oh, name them! Can't, falling asleep. The room moved as slowly as 15 miles per hour. But across desertorum or agricultural drearies, it attained 70, 97, 99, 100 red dogs.